Okay, let's get started. We're in Parshas Noach. And last week we studied the Meshech Chochma in one or two paragraphs on Bereishis. I wish we had more time to go beyond and speak about Tzelem Elokim. But now we're going on to a new topic, and this is Parshas Noach. Now, in Parshas Noach, after the Mabul, when the family of Noach with Noach leave the Teva, Hashem blesses them with the blessing of Pru Revu. And this is in the ninth chapter of Bereishis. If I had a Chumash here, maybe I could trouble you, perhaps, sure. In those Chumash that are sitting flat.
Bereishis, yeah.
Oh, so just if you don't mind opening up to the Perek Tes and just read the Pasuk. It's Pasuk Zion. I don't understand why Rav Kupim, when he published this, he didn't put the Pasuk on the thing. All the other publications of Meshech Chochma have the Pasuk.
Batem Peru Revu Shirtsu.
Ah, wait, before that? What's the Pasuk before that? It doesn't say by Varech?
Before Shefoch Dam Ha'adam Be'adam Demay Shafei Yitzel Elokim Asa Asadam.
And then it says Batem Peru Revu.
Okay. Shirtsu Ba'aretz Revu Ba'am.
Oh, we don't need all that. Fine. Now, Rabbi Simcha is going to take a stab at this, and the Gemara says that the mitzvah of Piri Verivya, of having children, is incumbent on the man, on the male, and not on the female. And he wants to see if he can come up with some sort of a thesis, an explanation as to why that's so. He says, Lo rachok hu lemar. It's not far away from possibility, meaning he's not absolutely convinced, because anytime you give an explanation for a law, it's always speculative. Ha shepotra haTorah noshim mipiri v'rivya v'chiva rak ha'noshim, and this is Gemara Masechta Yevamos, and it's Paskin by the Rambam and Hilchos Ishus Perek Tes Vav. So no one questions this premise. Even though it says that a woman should receive marriage herself rather than send a shliach, that's called mitzvah bayos mishlucha, that's because she has a voluntary mitzvah, and it's better, even if you're doing a voluntary mitzvah, to do it yourself personally rather than send a representative. But she's not obligated in the mitzvah. What's the explanation for that? Now, to my knowledge, no one has taken a stab at this. You know, this is the 20th century, and all these years have gone by. So we're going to learn about Rav Meir Simcha, how original he is, how revolutionary he is, to answer this question, that who would have the chutzpah to even raise the question? You know, if the Torah says men are chayv and not women, what explanation can I give for that? Ki mishpatei Hashem udrachav, darchinoam v'chol nesimoseh shalom. So Chazal, in many places, for example, in the third parak of Sukkah, they want to know if certain plants could be used as a lulav. And the Gemara goes into descriptions, and some of these lulavim have thorns in them, spikes in them. So Gemara rejects them. They can't be used for a lulav. There's no way the Torah would accept that, because Rachel Darchi Noam. Or, for example, let's say a woman is married and her husband dies leaving no children, so she falls for Yibum. But what happens if she has a child later on?
You mean?
She wasn't pregnant at the time of her husband's death. I mean, she didn't give birth before her husband's death, but she was pregnant, and she finds out later on. So what are you going to say now? That she went ahead and she, you know, she received chalitza, and now it turns out that the chalitza was completely possible from the beginning.
What's chalitza?
In other words, okay, let's leave out this case. I don't want to. I realize that I got off on a tangent. In any event, there's a principle that says, "Drachel darchinom." The ways of the Torah are pleasant. So, what is unpleasant about a woman being obligated in the mitzvah of having children? He says the following: V'lo amsa al ha'Yisraeli. This principle of drachel darchinom teaches me that the Torah will not impose an obligation on a Jew, if it's very difficult, nearly impossible for the physical body of the individual to implement that mitzvah, that command. Umikol davar asur lo manah Torah b'suga ha-heter. Anything that the Torah does prohibit, the Torah doesn't say you're completely excluded from it, because that would be something that the body can't accept. And therefore the Torah is not going to deny the possibility of enjoying that object in a different form. So there'll be two forms of the same object. So for example, the Gemara Chulin says that kol di osalon rachmona sharilon kavase, anything that was prohibited, the Torah will permit something that's very similar. So let's say, for example, we're not allowed to eat blood, but yet we're allowed to eat a liver, a kaved, and yet the liver is full of dam. Again, we have to remove some of the dam, but there's always going to be a taste of blood that's left in the liver. Or, for example, you can't have a relationship with a nida, but then there's something called dam tar. Let's say after a woman gives birth, right, vaginal blood does not make her tameh. Let's take, for example, chalev. You're not allowed to eat a certain part of the fats of an animal. That's called chalev. I left it open, but I guess somebody closed it. But let's say the chalev of a chayo, you're allowed to eat. So if anybody wants to take these pages, that's fine. Now, you're not allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman. Under what circumstance are you allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman? That's a parash called Eishes Yifas Toar. So we'll have a lot to say about that. We'll get exactly how that works. But a man, a Jewish man is out in battle and he sees a non-Jewish woman from the other side. And under certain conditions, he's allowed to marry her. So let's just summarize what we said until now. The Torah is very compassionate. The Torah could not obligate a Jew in something that physically he cannot tolerate. And even when the Torah prohibits something, there's always going to be something very similar that the Torah will permit, because to completely exclude from such a thing is impossible. So take, for example, a cheeseburger. You're not allowed to eat a cheeseburger. But today, they started creating, manufacturing, synthetic, synthetic meat. So they take a cell from an animal, and they can clone the cell, and they can really produce something that tastes exactly like meat. In such a case, the Torah doesn't recognize it as meat. There are many cases where the Torah doesn't recognize something as meat. And if this be the case, says Rav Meir Simcha, Mishum Zeh, Lo Matsanu Mitzvah Lis'anos, according to Torah law, Chak Yom Echad B'Shana, how many days in the calendar year do you have to fast? Only one, Yom Kippur. In other words, to ask a person to fast constantly, right, there are other religions that have that, the Torah felt that would be in violation of Drachel Darchinoam, your ways have to be pleasant. Now, when you fast, the Torah calls that inui nefesh, which means affliction of the body. So the Torah says you can tolerate affliction of the body one day out of the whole year. The other 364 days, eat, drink, and be merry. He goes on to say the following. V'kodem his hira v'chiva lechol. Even in that one day of the year, where you have to fast and afflict yourself, that's Yom Kippur, the Torah commands you to eat on the day before Yom Kippur. Again, there's a whole issue as to why, but the opinion of the Meshech Chacham is that the reason we want to eat before Yom Kippur is to make the fast that much easier. if you didn't have a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur, you might enter into Yom Kippur, you're already a little bit hungry, you haven't satiated yourself, and then it's going to be so much more difficult to fast on Yom Kippur. So the Torah goes out of its way, even when it prohibits something and demands affliction, to make it easier for you.
I know we walked in late, not intentionally. Can I just get the big picture of what the topic is we're talking about, so I understand the details?
Okay, the topic is going to, you'll see it's going to come up soon, is why is it that the Torah in Parshas Noach says that a man has to get married and have children, but a woman does not.
Okay.
So he's, the next point that you missed is that he's employing an overriding principle that applies throughout the halach and all the mitzvahs, that's called Durachel Darchei Noam, based on a pasuk in Mishlei. And in many cases, the Gemara activates that principle to explain why a certain situation would not be included in the mitzvah because it would cause you undue suffering.
And that's what that means in English. That
and the ways of the Torah are pleasant. Durachel Darchei Noam.
Thank you.
So the Torah doesn't want to upset the body, the physical body, and make it very difficult. So whatever the Torah prohibits, the Torah always gives you something that's permissible to make it easier to live a life of Torah. V'chein lo mona'a hamishgal mikol baneha levad mimosher aveinu. He says that an intimate relationship between a man and a woman is permitted, with the only exception, the only individual who was excluded was Moshe Rabbeinu. At a certain point in Moshe's life, we'll see as he develops this, Moshe had to separate himself from his wife. And this is based on a pasuk, the verse in Dvarim. You'll see this quoted in footnote number 7 if you want to underline it. Shuvu lachem li'olechem. After the Torah was given at Har Sinai, so we're on the second side, that's page Nun Aleph. The Torah says that although for 3 days before the Torah was given at Har Sinai, the men and the women had to separate, husbands and wives had to separate themselves, and immediately after the Torah was given, the command was Shuvu lachem li'olechem, meaning return to your tent. The idea of a tent is a symbolic reference to marital relations. But atem, the word atem means you, shuvu lachem lachem, va'ata, however you, Moshe Rabbeinu, po amod imadi, you stay behind with me. So because of this close relationship between the Shekhinah, between the divine being and Moshe Rabbeinu, he had to constantly be prepared to receive prophecy. Therefore, the Torah said he had to remain every single second in that high spiritual, pure state of concentration on communion with God. And therefore, at some point in Moshe Rabbeinu's career, he had to separate from his wife. Lufisha lo, because for Moshe Rabbeinu, hayitzarech legodel maloso, as a result of the great level that he was at, ulezehirus gufo, he had to be very careful about his physical state. He had to be in a constant physical state of purity. And the law is that after a man and a woman have relations, he has to go to the mikvah. Again, we don't have this today, but that's what it was originally. And certain Moshe Rabbeinu would not be at that moment in time before he purifies himself capable of receiving the divine word. So again, the main point is that for everyone throughout history, every Jew is allowed to have relations with a woman, of course under certain circumstances, and the Torah never said that a person has to be celibate. You know, maybe again in other religions there is such a thing, but not in our religion. The only exception was Moshe Rabbeinu. There's no other exception.
For how long was Moshe Rabbeinu in that state? Separated.
I think we're talking about 38 years, if I'm not mistaken. Again, if we had time, we'd go through that, but I don't want to get off on a tangent because we still didn't get to the main punchline of our discussion. Yeah, as to why a woman is exempt from the mitzvah of having children. That's what we want to get to. But before we get to that, We still have a little bit of a ways to go. And again, we're trying to show how the mitzvos of the Torah were given with compassion and with ways of pleasantness. So now, the Meshech Chochma turns to the case that we indicated before, which is called Eishes Yifas Tor. We'll try to explain what Eishes Yifas Tor is all about as we go along. He says, Yoser Mizeh, B'milchama, when we go out to battle, B'eis HaNitzachon, if we're victorious in the battle, again, there's a long discussion here, Rav Kuperman, in footnote number 8, about the fact that Rav Meir Simcha added these two words, a condition that it's got to be B'eis Nitzachon. That's the chiddush of Rav Meir Simcha. Once again, this is a complicated halachic discussion, but in any event, if we go out to battle and we win the battle, now we take captives. L'godel hachom v'archavas halev yoda kel deos ki oz lo yitochen la'atzor biyad haruach b'eis choshko b'eishes yifas tor. And the author here gets into a very, shall I say, dramatic, psychological discussion, almost poetry here, with every single word. He tries to describe the state of being, the psychological state of being of a person who goes out to war, and why the Torah would have recognized that it would be humanly impossible for him, under those particular circumstances, to overcome his craving, his desire. So let's go through these words, just at least superficially. L'godel hachom. Chom means there's an emotional, passionate intensity during the time of battle. Harchavat halev means that because war is so difficult and all the psychological pressures of a soldier in battle, the psychological response to that is harchavat halev, a desire to have pleasure. And there are many documented stories about soldiers who went wild after a battle, and they could not control their and satiate their desires. And therefore, Yoda, Kel Deos, he describes the Almighty as Kel Deos. He's the one who knows everything. He's omniscient. And he knows Ki Oz, under that situation, if you describe and understand the psychological state of a soldier, Lo yitochen, it would be literally impossible, la'atzor, to prevent, to inhibit him, bi'ad haruach, to overcome this passion of his, bi'eis choshko, bi'eishes yifas tor. When he fell in love, so to speak, he became passionately connected to this beautiful woman, and therefore, because the Torah realized that it would be too demanding under those unique circumstances, ha'torah hitira Yifas Tor, the Torah permitted marrying this so-called beautiful woman that he, you know, his heart connected to. Now, what we're saying here is, once again, Drachei Darchei Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasant. The Torah cannot possibly or feasibly impose upon a human being a situation which is against his very nature. So even when the Torah says fast for a day, it's Yom Kippur, which is against your nature, and it's an affliction of the body, the Torah sort of cushions it with the mitzvah of achila on Erev Yom Kippur. And again, it's only one day out of the year, so we assume that a person could fast for one day out of the year. And in a case where a person is overwhelmed with this desire and this craving because of the psychological state of mind that he's in after the battle, then the Torah permits the Eishes Yifas Tor. Now, if you take a look at footnote number 9 for a moment, he says, Afilu Eishes Ish, Hachidush Be'eishes Ish al Benahu, Bekach, Ki Bazeh, Bote Bitel Iser Ha'ese, Shal Vidovak Be'ishto. The author of this footnote is trying to tell us what the halachic considerations are with regard to a Jewish man having a relationship with a non-Jewish married woman. And that comes under what's called an Iser Aseh. When you take someone else's wife, even if she's not Jewish, that's a violation of an Iser Aseh. And in this particular case of Esh Yisifas Toar, the Torah is even going to allow the violation of this Iser Aseh. And where do you see this in the words of the Meshech Chachma? If you go back to where it has the footnote number 9, he says, Eishes Ish, she's a married woman. So all this is to tell us how far the Torah was willing to be lenient and to allow a situation which would under normal conditions be a serious violation of the Torah. And it's all because the Torah could not impose upon an individual a challenge that he could not possibly overcome.
In other words, in war, he can take her captive.
Correct. He takes her captive, and there's an entire procedure, a long ritual. It takes 30 days, and she has to grow this, and then she has to say goodbye to her parents. It's a whole long, complicated parasha. But at the end of the day, a woman who would, under normal circumstances, be prohibited, and the Torah permits it. Why? He says, Lo dibra Torah el keneged yetzahara. Because the Torah is speaking against the alluring power of the Yetzirah, which is the evil inclination. In this particular situation, the Matzav Hazeh, as we say in modern Hebrew, where the Yetzirah is so overwhelming, the Torah says, we're going to look aside and we're going to allow you to do this. Ukvar Herich Bazeh Mechaber Echad. Okay, he tells us that one of the authors has already written extensively on this topic. He doesn't tell you who that is. Umatsanu Echaya Zos Li Evan Pinala Avota Kabbalah. He says that the masters of our tradition, meaning the great rabbis over the centuries, saw this principle of Drachel Darche Noam as such a fundamental principle. Evan Pina. It's like a cornerstone. Shepatru miyibum misha mesu bonov acharkach. Okay, so here, remember, Ora, I was talking about the mitzvah of yibum. Now we can talk a little bit more about mitzvah of yibum. Imagine the following. Yibum means that he died. He was a married man. He died, left a widow, and he was childless. Now, what happens if he had a child? She doesn't fall for Yibum. In other words, the mitzvah of Yibum doesn't apply. What happens if he has a child and later on the child dies? Rahmanul Islam, something terrible happens. So now it turns out that we know that he's left without any progeny, without any zera. Should now, at this moment in time, which could be years after the death of the father, should his wife, his widow, now fall for Yibum? Now, if she falls for Yibum, then she's not allowed to get married to anyone. So imagine a situation where she went off and married someone, and now you're telling me, what, we're going to revoke the marriage? Okay, are you following this? It's a little bit complicated. Yeah, okay, Yibum. So again, I don't want to spend the whole time in this, but we'll see if we can get it down. Right, so let's say Reuven is married to Leah. And Reuven dies, and he's childless. This is the classic case of Yibum. So Leah cannot remarry until we relieve her from that marriage situation. Why? Because she falls for Yibum. Why? Because Reuven has a brother named Shimon, and Shimon now has to marry Leah.
Okay, that's
in order. There's a fancy word for this in English, but I forgot. Leverite. I don't know how to pronounce all those words because I wasn't brought up in an art school generation. That's my problem.
That's right. Now I'm with you.
But she now falls for Yibum to Shimon. So the mitzvah is that Shimon marries her, and the children are called on the name of Reuven. That's how Reuven's soul, so to speak, has some sort of comfort. What happens in the following scenario? Reuven dies, but he left a son or a daughter, it doesn't matter. He left a child. So at this point, there's no mitzvah of Yibum, which means that she can get married to anyone she wants, except for Kohen. Well, no, she can marry Kohen too. She's an Alman. She can't marry Kohen Gadol. Okay, fine. So she can get married to anyone she wants to. And then, if it's 10 years later, I'll just dramatize it, this child dies. So logically, you would say that at this point, she should now No, she logically, I'm saying in pure logic, she should now fall for Yibam. She should need Yibam. Why? Because it turns out that her husband has no Zera. There's no one to survive him because he only had one son in this case,
right.
And that son died. So what happened during that 10-year period? She didn't know whether he was going to live or die. She assumed that he was alive and well, he was healthy. She got married to someone else. So imagine if now we're going to bust up her marriage. We're going to say that she cannot be married because she has to fall for Yibum. So the Chazal say, it's Gemara Masechet Yevamos, that no, she doesn't fall for Yibum because since her husband left the child at the time of his death and there was no Yibum at that point, then it would be unpleasant, to say the least. I mean, that's understating it. It would be a violation and irritation of Drachei Dachei Noam if we would now apply the mitzvah, activate the mitzvah of Yibum. Okay, fine. Now we get to the punchline of our whole discussion. Why is it that the Torah imposed a mitzvah, an obligation on a man to get married and have children, but not on a woman? I mean, intuitively I would say if anyone should be obligated, it should be the female. I mean, she's the one who's going to have to bear the child. Says Rabbi Simcha, V'im Kain, based on this overarching principle of Drachei Dachei Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasant, Nashim Shemisaknos, or I should read it, Mistaknos Be'ibur Veleda. Now you may have heard this before, but if you ever heard it, it's all because of this one line in the Meshech Chachma. Says Rabbi Simcha, for a woman to get pregnant and give birth involves a risk. Her life is in risk. Now, how statistically, I mean, I'm not a statistician, I don't know statistics, but what are the probabilities that a woman who gives birth is going to die at childbirth? And unfortunately, we hear of such tragedies, but it's not what you call ma'isim b'chol yom. It's not so common.
In those days.
Yeah,
could be that in those days it was common. But in any event, the Meshech Chochma adds the following sentence. And here he's quoting a Mishnah in Ksubas to prove his point. Because again, right now his point is very, it's very iffy. You can really argue against the... Who says that halachically, the Torah's eyes, birth for a woman, childbirth is considered a risk to her life? Who? Which birdie, whispered that in the ears of Rabbi Simcha? So he says the following: Mishum ze amru misa shchicha. Okay, this is based on a Mishnah in Ksubas. We're going to try to see if we can understand what that means. Literally translated, misa shchicha means that death is common. Common. In other words, it's statistically a serious probability theory. How does he know this? Ayin Tosfos, Pei Gimel Amud Beis, Divrei Ramaskel Misa Shchicha. So this entire discussion is in Masechet Ksubos. I'm mentioning that just for anyone who wants to look this up. And there on Daf Pei Gimel Amud Beis, the Gemara establishes that Misa is Shchicha. And Tosfos adds the following words. He says, you'll see this in footnote number 17, Shema Mishum Derov Pa'amim Mistakenes Beleda. In most situations, there's an element of risk in a woman giving birth. If I had to guess what the statistical probability of a woman dying in childbirth, I'm not sure if it's even 1%. But perhaps, as you say very well, back in the day, maybe it was 10%, maybe it was 20%, or somewhere in the middle, I don't know. But it was statistically probable enough to qualify as a sakana.
Well, we consider a chola shirish was sakana for 3 days after she gives birth too, right?
So correct.
You violate Shabbos for it. So.
Yeah, you're right. Why doesn't the Rameh Simcha quote that as a proof?
Can you explain what that is?
For the first 3 days after birth, we violate the Shabbos so she doesn't fast on Yom Kippur. because she's in a state of danger.
Considered as if she's
in a state of danger.
Right.
Okay.
The person has been good.
Yeah.
In terms of the argument, it seems a bit shivach. In other words, the fact that the man is the chiyuv, he still requires the woman to fulfill that chiyuv. So it's a strange. It seems like a strange argument to me.
Well, he's saying that in a technical way, the halacha operates with chiyuvim and pturim.
Right.
And although a woman certainly could volunteer if she wants to get married and bear children, she's not obligated, because one of the conditions in obligating is that it has to be drachel darchino.
I understand, but the fact that he's obligated, and the only
he's got to find a woman who's willing to volunteer.
No, you know what I'm saying? The only way he can fulfill his obligation is with a woman. So that,
but he has to find a woman who would volunteer for this.
I understand, but the difference is minimal.
Not sure I understand your point. Again, can we impose an obligation on a person when that
she
obligation...
She doesn't have the technical obligation, but she must be involved in the process.
No single... You cannot isolate or identify any single woman who has to be part of the process.
How does the man fulfill the obligation?
He's going to... Again, as I said, I'll say it 15 times. I can't say it more. He's got to find... He's got to find a woman who voluntarily would take it upon us.
I understand what you're saying, but...
So look, I think you should hold off because we're only at the beginning. The Meshech Chachma is going to go a step further and say that there's a certain nature of the woman. So again, I don't want to give everything out at the beginning.
No,
so would you
like
be
very,
willing?
It's a very technical. It looks like it sounds like to
again.
Me,
you have to see. This is I always have this problem because. When I teach, I don't know, for me this is such an educational challenge that I never know how to solve it. When you see the whole picture, you'll begin to see how beautiful his approach is. Okay. So now, you know, I don't know what to do. Should I give you an hour's lecture to try to answer your question, or should we see the way he develops it? Which way do you want
to
go?
It's
up to you.
You have to tell people to hold their questions, so I know the story.
I don't know. That's what I get so much flack because you should know the biggest critique I get it right here in this space registers is that I don't answer questions. But I come from a school that you should know there's a whole sugya about when you're allowed to ask a question, when you're not. When you're in a presentation and you haven't even begun to see the whole picture, it's very difficult to answer questions. I don't know. So again, I ask for mechila, I ask for your forgiveness, but perhaps you can give Rabbi Simcha the benefit of the doubt. He was quite a giant. And I'm going to try to convince you that. You know, every time you come to this class, we're going to go even a step further and try to convince you as a giant. But right now, I'm going
to... Back to the topic.
I can't take questions now. You know, this question is so pressing that I feel compelled to answer it. And the only way I can do that is if we see... You know, Rabbi Simcha is going to have a beautiful presentation. There are two types of chukim. There are two types of statutes. There's what's called Chukei HaTeva, the way God created nature. There's Chukei HaMitzvah, the way God imposes mitzvahs. And we're going to see the interface between those two. Again, you know, we haven't even really gotten to the kishkes of it. Let me just point out one other thing. How do we know that women are exempt from the mitzvah of bearing children? The Gemara says that there's one extra word in the pasuk. It says... In the pasuk, pruravu umeluas haaretz, and then it says vikiv shuha, and thou shalt conquer the land. Now the word vikiv shuha, conquering, has a definite context to it, and that's the mitzvah of milchama. Now, if I were to tell you that every mitzvah of the Torah is governed by the law of Drachel Darchi Noam, and then I tell you that the Torah would never impose an obligation upon a person to put his life into danger, what mitzvah would you ask me about? Which by its very essence forces you to put your life into danger. Mitzvah Melchama. Right? So a soldier's going to say, well, I'm not going to go out to battle. Why? Because Drachel Darchi Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasantness, and I know if I go out to battle, I might get hit. You know, just to say to them. So the only exception to the rule where you have a mitzvah that forces you to put your life into danger by the very essence of the mitzvah is milchama. The Gemara says that only men are obligated in milchama, not women. That's called, again, I don't have time to go through all the words here, so you'll just have to hear it for those who know it. And that's called Darka Shal Ish Lichbosh V'ein Darka Shal Ish Al Lichbosh. A man goes out to war and a woman doesn't go out to war. So in that one first case, that one exceptional case where the mitzvah forces you to put your life into danger, the Torah once again imposes that mitzvah on men and not on women. So that we don't have a precedent that could allow us for the Torah to impose an obligation on women to get pregnant and to give birth. Because that precedent only applies to men and not to women. So the mitzvah milchama is so significant because the Torah wants us to conquer the land, the Torah wants us to defend the land. So therefore the Torah says even if it means putting your life into danger, you have to do so. But even that case of milchama is only imposed upon men and not upon women. Let's go on. V'chein, muteres lishtos kos nikrin. There's a certain kind of a potion, which is called a kos nikrin, that causes impotence. And here's the difference in halacha between a man and a woman. Ke'uvda de Yehudit de Besu de Rabbi Chanina besof perek haba al yevimto. It means that according to the Gemara, the Talmud, at the end of a certain chapter in Masechet Yevamos, if a woman needs to take a certain medicine for her health, but as a result of this medicine she will not be able to bear children, the Gemara says that she's allowed to take the medicine. A man would not be allowed to take that medicine, again, unless his life was in danger, but under normal circumstances, if it's a regular illness and he'll survive, then he's enjoined from taking this medicine because what? Because it will cause him impotence. And he's obligated in the mitzvah of Piri Verivya. So if you take a look in footnote number 18, he quotes the whole sugya, word for word, in Masechet Yevamos. And the Gemara is talking about the daughter of Rabbi Chia, her name was Yehudit. And Havilei Tzar Leda, she was very sensitive to the pain of giving birth. And the physicians say that it's going to be very hard for her, and she's already had a very tormenting experience. And she came in front of Rav Chia to ask if she could take a kos ikrin. And she said, Issa is a woman, Mifkida, period of Rivi, she obligated the mitzvah of having children. Why do I have to... Why do I have to avoid taking this medicine? Amalolo, she's not obligated in the mitzvah of having children. Ozla ashte samadakrasa. So she went ahead based on this response and she drank this samadakrasa. Sama means a drug, dakrasa, that makes her into an akara. That's the language of the Gemara. Now Rav Kupavin adds the following comment. Achresha hochiach rabbeinu ki isha eina mitzuva b'mitzvahs piri v'rivya. And why is she exempt from this mitzvah? Ekev because of the sakana, the danger. Akrucha b'shas leida kashelo madu efo kavala hachokateva es hacheshek lo ledes biot hachok eloki shichrer osa ben mitzvah. Rav Kupavin is giving an introduction here to the next paragraph. Again, it wasn't broken up in the text as a separate paragraph. And Rav Meir Simcha is now answering a question which is implicit. And that is, there seems to be a contradiction between two overall rules, not rules, that's bad, two laws, two systems of law, let's call it that. Chok here means a system of law. There are two systems of law. There's the biological system of law that relates to teva, to nature, and then there's another system of law which is ethical, which is divine, which is mandated by the Torah. There seems to be a contradiction, because what Rav Meir Simcha knows, and it's clear from the verses in the Torah, is that on a natural level, a woman has a tremendous desire to bear children. We're going to see this from the parasha of Rachel. Rachel comes to Yaakov, she cannot bear children, and she says, Yaakov, you have to somehow, you know, with your magical connection on high, you have to change my nature so that I can bear children. V'im ayin, and if not, mesa anochi. Rachel says she'll die. I have a pretty emotional story to tell you, not about Rachel, you mean about a woman who at childbirth, after so many years of being barren, she finally was able to bear a child, but the child was endangering her life, and there was a choice whether to save the baby or she would perish, or save her life and the baby would perish. And she begged the physician to allow the baby to be born. So that's this concept that we see by Rachel Aminu. Havo libanim v'in ayin mesa anochi. That's the verse. So now we have a strange kind of situation. On the one hand, God instills in a woman the natural desire to bear children. And you see it, how profound it is in the case of Rachel. On the other hand, the Torah has a different chok, a different law that says that she's not obligated to put her life into danger. Isn't there some sort of contradiction between the two laws? Now keep in mind that the natural law is the law of God. God created nature. So God created a female in a way that she would have a desire to have children, and yet he says to her, you don't have the mitzvah of having children. When he gets to the Chok HaElokhi, which is the divine system of ethics and law, he exempts a woman. Here's where Rav Meir Simcha tries to reconcile these two. This is line 5, right? Rak l'kiyum ha-min, because God wants the world to be populated, that's called Kiyum Amin. Also Bitiva, he changed her nature, or shall we say he engineered her nature in a natural sense, Shetshukasa, that her desire is Laholit, to have children, Aza. She has an even more powerful, more profound desire to have children, Mishela Ish, than even a man. Again, how Rav Meir Simcha knows this, I don't know. But we don't find anywhere in the Torah where a man says, if I don't bear children, then mesa anochi, I'm dead. But in Rachel's case, Hava libanim v'im ayin mesa anochi. He tells you where the pasuk is in Parshas Vayeshev, I believe. Anyway, in Parshas, he tells you where it is, Perek Lamed. Ubazen nicha. Now I can understand. Hachti Omar Rav Yosef beperek Habal Yevimto. The ein nashim mitzuvos bepiri v'rivya mehacha. How do we know that a woman is exempt from piri v'rivya? And we derive it from a pasuk in Bereishis Perek 32. Ani kel shakai pre urive. Notice that in this context, the words prey urevei are in the Hebrew grammatical singular. Whereas elsewhere the Torah says pru urevu in the plural. So Rav Yosef in Masechta Yevamos again derives from the deliberate use of the singular that man is obligated in piri urevi, but not woman. If it was both him and her, then it would have said pru urevu. So now the question is, but the Torah does say Puravu. Where does it say Puravu? At the beginning of the Torah. And that when God addresses Adam and Chava, in Bereishis Perek Aleph, he says to them, Puravu, in the plural, implying that Chava was no less obligated by this mandate than Adam. Says Rav Meir Simcha, Hainu, di Adam v'Chava, Shebirech Osam Kodem Hachet. That bracha took place immediately after Adam and Chava were created, before the sin, before they ate from the Eitz Hadas. In the aftermath of the Eitz Hadas, she was punished with what's called a tsar leda, which means that she would have extreme pain at childbirth. But before that point of Cheta Egel, Lo Hayel Atzar Leda, is therefore Hayem Mitzvah Shneem Bepiri of Arivia. She had no less of a mitzvah to Piri of Arivia. So again, in the ideal situation, If not for the danger involved in the process of childbirth, a woman would be obligated in this mitzvah. There's no reason that she shouldn't. This mitzvah is not a time-bound mitzvah. There's nothing inherent in this mitzvah that should exclude a woman. The only issue is Rachel Dachinon because of the danger situation. If there was no danger, there was no tzar later, which is other reason before the chet, she would be obligated. And that's why the Gemara says that the derivation to exempt a woman is from prey urevei in the singular. But as far as other mechav is concerned, that command was in the plural pru urevu. Unbelievable how Rabbi Simcha is putting all the pieces of the puzzle together.
And the fact that you have pru urevu in Noach is, in other words, it's in the plural here in Noach.
Correct. That's going to come up soon. He says, "Avoliachar achet shahoyel atzar leida vayarov pa'amim mistakenes misa." Again, he's paraphrasing that Tosfos in Yevamos that mentioned before that misa is shchicha, that misa is common. Again, not common in the sense that it's 51%, but it's a high percentage. Is therefore a woman is exempt from period of erivia because after the chet there's already the violation of the principle of drachel darchinon. Ad ki amru, the Gemara goes very far in describing the tsar, the pain that a woman feels. You know, this is before epidurals. You know, and when she gives birth, isha nishbas, she takes an oath, shalos tizdakek labaila, that she'll never have a relationship with her husband in a way that she might get pregnant again. And as a result, the Gemara says that in order to alleviate her from that responsibility to uphold that oath, she's got to bring a korban, a certain sacrifice. Lachain b'Noach, well, here's your question about Noach. Aftichtiv, even though it says Vayomer lehem pru urevu, so this would seem to undermine the thesis of Rabbeir Simcha. Why does the Torah address Noach when he comes out of the Teva in the plural that they, you in the Uste, right? You in the plural have to fulfill this mitzvah. Haloksiv kodem lachay. That's why I asked you to read the pasuk, but we didn't see it. Let's see 28. Do you have the chumash open there? It's 20. What does it say? 23. I can't read it. It's a little erased in my. Oh, at the beginning of chapter 9, what does it say?
Pasuk 7.
No, wait, we'll get to Pasuk 7, but first go back to the...
The Pasuk Aleph is Vayivarech Elokim.
Oh, Vayivarech Osam Elokim Lemar. Well, again, could you read it?
Vayivarech Elokim Es Noach Es Banav.
Bas Banav.
Vayamar Lahem Peru.
Oh, so Rabbi Simcha has a whole what I call a shtickel Torah here, a whole chiddush. He says that if you take Pasuk 9 in conjunction with the opening verse, the introduction to this whole chapter, which is Pasuk number 1, you'll realize that Noach was granted a bracha at the opening line, as it says, Vayivarech es Noach ves banav. And this bracha, this blessing, was bestowed upon the male members of Noach. Avol neshem lo hizkir. She'enon bechlal mitzvahs period of erivia. So when the Torah in Pasuk 9 utilizes the plural, it's referring to the beginning of this parasha, which says Noach ve'ezbanav, which is a reference to the male members of his family. So it's written in plural, but the Torah is indicating that the plural is a reference to all the male members of the family of Noach. Ubi Yaakov ka'amar prey urevei. But when it comes to Yaakov Avinu, where there was no introduction that would imply that we're indicating only the males, the Torah had to go out of its way to use the singular. And with this, he answers an unbelievable question. You know, why is it that with regard to Noach, it says Puravu, when the Gemara says that men are obligated and not women, and therefore it should have said Prey Reveh, like it says by Yaakov? The answer is because in the case of Noach, the Torah went out of its way to introduce this parsha, this section of the Torah, by addressing the men. Okay. Just one second. I just want to see if I left anything out that I wanted to add here from the footnotes. Yeah. Okay. Now, at this point, how are we doing on the clock? Okay, we still have a few minutes. At this point, Rav Meir Simcha is going to take his thesis one step further. He says, "Od yitochen lomar." It's possible. B'tam shepotra Torah not should be piri verivya. He says the following: is it necessary for the Torah to mandate that which is natural? Do you follow my point? In other words, we have these two systems of law. We have the natural system of law, and in this case he presents the thesis that God had to instill in a woman that natural desire and craving to be a mother in order for Kiyum HaMin, so the Min would go. On the other hand, in terms of the divine law, the Chok Eloki, he couldn't possibly impose this obligation on women because of the problem that there cannot be a mitzvah, meaning an obligation, which violates the principle of Dorcher Darchinon. So what God did to reconcile this is, you know, the Shnei Ksuvim HaMachrishim said there's a contradiction. On the one hand, in the law of obligations, there cannot be a Chok Eloki that would obligate a woman in Piri Verivya. On the other hand, the world could not exist if a woman doesn't get involved in Piri Verivya. So here's where God introduced the Chok Tiv'i, right? The natural propensity of a woman to desire to have children. Now Rav Meir Simcha is offering another technical rule. And what is it? That the Torah would not obligate a person in something that is so natural, there's such an intense desire to do so. That's not what the Chok Eloki is. The 613 mitzvos require either overcoming your natural desire, your yetzara, your inclination, or it's neutral. You know, you wouldn't have known that I have to do this. I don't know, I have to send away the mother bird. I don't know, whatever case it might be. But he says when there's a natural chok tiv'i and a craving of a person to do a mitzvah, then there's no chok eloki, that it's pointless. Let's read it inside. Hatam shepotra hatorid noshim mipiri verivya mishum deve emes alo hitbia b'teva tshuka. Correct, we had the pasuk after the chet harishon where the Torah said vel ishech tshukasech, and we saw by Rachel that she said im ayin mesa nochi. So it's obvious that the natural craving of a woman is to bear children. Ubrekeva o yoser, to what extent does a woman have a desire to get married and have children? Ad kedekach, to the extent to which the Gemara says at the beginning of the second parak of Kiddushin, tabla meisan tandu mila meisav armalo. You know what that means? That means that a woman would even be willing to get married to a zlub, you know, somebody who's a Rashi says he's a mukashchin, you know, he has a very, very severe dermatological disease, and she would even be willing to marry him if she has no choice. Again, some people say that today that no longer applies. So that's a very controversial issue. I'm not going to get into that. My Rebbe got involved in this. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, I don't want to get into that. Therefore, vidai, what does the word vidai mean? There's no need. Vidai means it's enough. Leave well enough alone. There's no need to add from the outside an external divine mandate on something that is so intensely natural and so desirable. Now here we want to look at footnote number 26 on the bottom of the page. Ein haTorah tzricha lahosif mitzvah b'makom shateva b'lav hachi mechayev. If God created the world in such a way that it's natural for a person to want to do this, and there's no challenge whatsoever, he doesn't need to add a mandate. So God has two choices. He can achieve his goal either by creating a certain nature in man, or he can achieve the goal of challenging man to go against his nature or overcome his nature. In the case of a woman, there was no need for the Torah to impose a chiyuv under the law of Chukei HaTorah. How does he call it? Chukei HaTorah. Yeah, Chukei HaTorah. Because he already has achieved that goal. He's guaranteed, he's clinched it through Chukei HaTeva. Valkane, the ikar ha-mitzvah he kamod estan b'yavamos lo yavatel odom mipiri v'rivya elim ke yesh lo bonim. Right, a person is not allowed to remain single, we're talking about a male, unless he has children, and he has a machlokas, how many children he has to have. Beit Shammai says it's enough he has two male children. Beit Hillel says he has to have one male and one is female, which we derive from a pasuk Zohar in the cave of Bara'am. Tiv nasa isha v'lo yolda. How far does the Torah have to go to impose this obligation on a male to have children? It's unbelievable. The Torah is going to say that if he lives with a woman and she can't have children, then he has to marry a second wife. Now again, in the Torah law, he's allowed to marry a second wife. That's not true in our time because of what's called Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, but in the pure theoretical Torah, a man could marry a second wife. Now by marrying a second wife, he doesn't undermine the love that he has with his first wife. Again, you could argue on this in many different ways. But let's go with Rabbi Simcha's premise. So he hasn't divorced his first wife, but rather he's married to a second wife as well. Again, she may be a little jealous, but let's say he can iron it out. Like Yaakov Avinu, who had two wives, and maybe four wives. Ubiderech, umiderech ha-Torah, libli ligdor ha-teva. Right, the Torah doesn't want to undermine the nature. So on the one hand, you know, it might be that a man will say, I'm in love with this woman, she can't bear children, I don't care about it, that's fine with me. And now the Torah says, but you have to have children. So the Torah now is going to say, well, marry another woman to have children. So he could marry both women. He's married at the same time to the love of his life, and the second woman to bear children, hopefully he loves her too. But now he can fulfill his obligation of period of Arivia.
Okay,
give me one more minute. And therefore, Kayotzi Bazer Omru Darcheha Darcheinom Poshka Savti Lachain Ligzal Isha. Why couldn't the Torah command a woman in the midst of period of Arivia and Kitinos Elish Velo Yolid? Why not allow that in a situation where, on the one hand, she's obligated period, on the other hand, she can't. This marriage is not successful in terms of having children. So she loves this man, but he cannot, or together they cannot have children. So then, the only possibility here to impose upon her an obligation to fulfill period of Rivia would be that she get divorced from her husband. Do you follow? Because the Torah doesn't allow her to be married to two men at the same time. So as a man is, again, we have to discuss why, but whereas a man is allowed to be married to two women, a woman cannot be married to two men. If you're going to impose upon her an obligation to have children, she might have to divorce her husband, and in the romantic language of the Meshech Chochma, teitze me'ahuv nafsha, from her beloved, in order to tikash ish acher, in order that she should get married to another man and have children, v'zeneged ateva. Lehov, he says, lehov asanui v'listo ha'ohu. Wow, he uses some really extreme language over here. But Meir Simcha says that it would be like she has to hate her beloved and be divorced from him, and she's got to marry someone else just simply to bear children. She doesn't love this man. That's against the Teva. It's a double whammy that she has to be divorced from one man that she loves in order to be married to another man who she doesn't love simply for the sake of Piri River. That would undermine the natural law and would irritate the principle of Drachea Darchinom. Raka'ish, only in the case of a man, we can force him to marry another woman if he cannot find that his first wife, his beloved, bears children. Sheyachal Lisa Odacheres, because he could be married to two women at the same time. Therefore, Olav Hitila Torah Mitzvah, the Torah imposed upon him a mitzvah which would never force him to divorce his beloved wife. Because even in the event that she doesn't bear children, he doesn't have to divorce her. He can marry a second wife. Now here again, we don't have any time to continue, but maybe next week, if we have time, I want to learn with you footnote number 32. Because this really puts a lot of what we're going to see in the future in Rabbeinu Simcha in perspective. Again, it's a separate topic, but nevertheless a very important one. So, Ora, what was the question that was on your mind? If we could just open up the door in case anybody wants to learn surrogacy, I don't know.
Now I can have a surrogate. You wouldn't have to marry someone else. You can have a surrogate.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Wow, that would be an introduction to my next lecture. Let me think about this. Brilliant, brilliant. So, Ora is asking the following question. That a woman, if she were obligated in period of Arivia, just one second. So I understand that she won't have to divorce her husband because of surrogacy. Yeah, but that's...
I'm talking about the man. The man doesn't have...
Oh, okay.
But another woman
right. That could be. But again, there are so many issues why a woman cannot bear children to a man. I don't know if surrogacy is always going to be the solution to that problem. But I think you were asking an even more brilliant question. Why can't a woman be obligated to have children? And in event that she cannot have children from this husband, she could fulfill her obligation through surrogacy.
Well, that could happen too.
Yeah, but that also, I don't think, is a difficult question, because there may be situations in which she cannot fulfill the mitzvah period through surrogacy. But that depends on who's actually the mother of the child. That's a real discussion. Okay, my friends, let's stop here. There's a lot here. Again, I tried to fit it all in. I'm not sure if I did. And then we have footnote number 32. If you have a chance, take a look at footnote number 32. You have it on those pages. Let me.